welcome to the Poem of the Week. Each week, our poems are intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes and Essential Evidence Senior Editor Dr. Mark Abel. Gentlemen.
Good day, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing, Mike?
Good. Today, you've picked a poem that's going to talk about pap smears, one of the great success stories in public health over the past 100 or so years, not quite 100 years. It was 1941 when we began to look at the pap smear. And since then, it's been used all over the world with, at least in Western European countries and North America, huge reductions in cervical cancer. Then, perhaps a decade or even more recently, along came the human papillomavirus testing to cervical cancer screening, and that's improved detection of cervical neoplasms even more and allowed us to stratify women based on risk. It gets a little complicated when we begin to talk about cytology, something we do, I guess, at cocktail parties and the like. The current terminology for reporting cervical cytology includes the atypical squamous cells, it's abbreviated ASC, which differ from normal cells but don't meet the criteria for pre-malignant disease, one which would be called squamous intraepithelial neoplasia, also abbreviated SIL. So we get to this ASC category, as ASC US means undetermined significance, or ASCH, which is the high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion. Lesion a lot easier to say. Anyways, this whole area of what do we do when we get these abnormal pap smears back has confused a lot of us, and there are lots of recommendations. The incidence of these different abnormalities varies by location, by age group, by sexual practice, and interestingly, by country. In North America, about 96% of women who get a pap smear will have a normal pap smear. About 3% will have this ASC US, undetermined significance. About 1% will have a low-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions, and a very small percent, about a quarter of 1%, will have high grade. Anyways, what do we do with this? Typically, there's been a couple of different options. We can go on after the pap smear and get the HPV testing. In many labs, this is done just as reflex testing. Alternatively, we can wait a period of time. Your poem this week that you've selected comes from the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, published toward the end of 2016. It starts on electronic page 1 and goes through 15. It's in volume 48. It asks the clinical question, is colposcopy with biopsy better than repeat cytology alone within 6 months to prevent invasive cervical neoplasia? What did they find, Mark, and how does this affect what we should be doing with our female patients?
Well, I think this is a big piece of the a big piece of the puzzle. And as you said, the question is for women coming in with ascus or LSIL, should we just repeat the cytology within 6 months? Is that 6 month interval the appropriate one, or could we wait longer? Or should we jump to colposcopic biopsy immediately for these women? So this was a huge cohort study from Sweden, essentially included all women in the country aged 22 to 50 years who underwent cervical cancer screening during the period from 1989 to 2011. That's about 2.5 million women. Within that group, about 200,000 had one of these findings, ascus or LSIL. So they found about this large group that had an initial cytology, and they looked at what kind of follow-up they received. And then they were also able to link that to databases tracking the incidence of invasive cervical cancer. Obviously, the worry is if we delay or if we just do repeat cytology without making a definitive diagnosis, there's a risk that the cancer or the precancerous lesion may progress to an invasive lesion. And they classified the follow-up as either having had colposcopy with biopsy or follow-up with cytology only or no follow-up. And women were followed up for a median of about 10 years. So some of the women as little as 5 years, four years, I think, and some as many as 15 years. There was a lot of data. One of the tables in the study had 30 incidence rate ratio. So the incidence rate ratio, which was their main outcome, is the ratio of the likelihood of invasive cervical cancer in women who got cytology divided by the incidence in women who got colposcopy with biopsy. Did those just getting cytology have an increased risk? So you'd like to see a number around one, which means they had the same risk. And what you don't want to see is numbers much over one, because that means they were at greater risk for cancer. So I kind of try to pull out the key results, and it differed by age, which isn't too surprising. You know, cancers vary by age, as does HPV infection and a lot of the risk factors for cervical cancer. So in young women, 22 to 27, who had ascus, there was essentially no difference between repeating cytology at 0 to 6 months, repeating it at 7 to 25 months, or biopsy. So they were all equally good strategies. For women 28 to 50, there was an increased risk with repeat cytology at 0 to 6 months compared to biopsy, about twofold increase in risk. And that was the same for LCIL as well. And in the younger women with LCIL, they also had about a twofold increase. Wasn't statistically significant, but the magnitude was similar with all the other increases. And they especially had an increase in risk if these younger women with LCIL waited more than 6 months. They had a fivefold increase in the risk of invasive cancer. So these are fairly small numbers. You know, the relative risk of five sounds big. They were a small absolute number. But clearly, this is a very preventable cancer, and it really argues very strongly for a policy of either immediate biopsy in all of the women with LCIL, or at a minimum, no more than 6 months until you get that repeat cytology. And it says that for those younger women, 22 to 27 with ascus, it's perfectly fine and just as safe to do cytology only. The biggest risk, not surprisingly, was in those women who had no follow-up at all. Their incidence rate ratio was between 5 and about 20, far higher than any group. So I think one of the other messages is we need systems to track these women so that a 4-month follow-up or a 6-month doesn't turn into a 12 or a 24 or a never follow-up. I think that's especially true in the U.S., where our population is very mobile. We don't share data. We don't have a single health system. We don't have a single EHR. So that's really on us to try to make sure we take good care of those patients by keeping careful track of them.
Right. It's very interesting. I mean, I think that younger women will love to hear this news that they can have a repeat pap smear and not have to have colposcopy. Those women 28 to 50, perhaps a little bit more worrisome, as you're mm-hmm. suggesting. I have a little bit different spin, and I certainly want to stay away from any heated political discussion. But it is not uncommon to have opportunities for women of low socioeconomic means to get pap smears. When you move from pap smears now to colposcopy, you're talking about a relatively expensive test. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not heart transplant, but it's still in the hundreds of dollars if you mm-hmm. add the test, the procedure, and then the pathologist mm-hmm. to read it and things. And if we don't have a system to pay for that, it doesn't really make much sense to do the pap smear, right, and get these abnormal results and then say, well, you know, you've got to do this, but I don't know where you can get this test. So it's an access issue, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, it depends on where you live. It may be easier to access a colposcopy or find a practice that accepts patients without insurance in an urban area or where there's a medical school or where there are residency training programs. It's going to be a lot harder for patients living in rural areas who may also have transportation problems around that. I mean, those are the kind of clinics I've practiced in for much of my career, so I'm acutely aware of that.
Yeah. And even that's changing. Being at an urban medical center, we would not have any place to do a colposcopy for a poor woman. Mm-hmm. We'd have to send them to a federally qualified health center or a county.
Yeah. Just to add a point, I mean, you know, one of the things that actually first got me interested in evidence-based medicine really was the fact that I went out into a rural clinic where I was the only doctor in the county, and it was most of my patients didn't have insurance. And I started asking, gee, are these old blood pressure drugs? I still remember we had a huge jar of hydrochlorothiazide tablets that we could dispense. And yet, I'd left a medical center where everyone was using the latest calcium channel blocker that was a lot more expensive, and just started asking questions about, is this new stuff really any better? Mm-hmm. And so it all had its roots in these kind of situations.
Yeah, very important. I hope that our medical students today are learning those same lessons. Anyways, thanks, Mark. Very practical poem. We'll talk with you again next week.
Good talking to you, Mike.
Well, that's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read this and other recent poems, please go to www.essentialevidence.com. And please join us again next week for another medical poem. Oh,